The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So to talk about the Four Noble Truths, part of the reason to talk about them is that they're at the heart of what the Buddha had to teach. And the Buddha said once that the Four Noble Truths are the unique or the special teachings of the Buddhas. The Buddha taught many things which were not unique to him, but the Four Noble Truths, you know, were identified as what was special. And so to talk about it today from a little different, start from a different angle than maybe usual, talk about how we use our minds. And, you know, it's not that common for people to get curious about how our minds function. And, you know, but today we have a researcher who's very interested in that topic. But most people, when they go about their daily life, and sometimes their whole life, there is not a lot of reflection or inward looking at the functioning of their own mind. And which is unfortunate, because the mind is a phenomenal instrument. And as we understand how the mind functions, we can influence that instrument. We can have some impact on it. And certainly has a big impact on us. And sometimes the impact that our mind has on us is one that's, deleterious, one that brings suffering and sorrow, pain, all kinds of problems. And without kind of turning the attention around to look at the nature of this mind, how the mind functions, we can't take responsibility. We can't be involved in changing this mind in some way. So the alternative to turning around and looking at how the mind works and functions is, I think, for many people, is to have the mind focused outwards, have attention focused outwards, to have our preoccupation focused outwards. And I like to think about this outward focus on is the mind is involved in aboutness. Mind is about something. So if you're thinking about work, you're thinking about work. It's not work. And so you're thinking about something that's out there, in a sense. Work may be tomorrow or the next day. If you're thinking about what happened at work yesterday, again, your mind is about something. It's focusing on something. If you're thinking about yourself, about your problems, then even though it's kind of focused inward in a sense, your mind is still thinking about something. There's a concern that our thoughts, our imagination, is involved in focusing on. And a person can spend a lifetime having their attention focused on the world of aboutness, thinking about things. And it can be, there's a lot of important things to think about. And so, it's not that we're not supposed to think about things, but there's appropriate times to think about things and times to not think about things. But many people live in the world of aboutness. They live in the world of their mind thinking about things, being concerned about things, sometimes obsessively, and sometimes not so obsessively. I like to think of this aboutness, the mind that's focused on something, something we're thinking about, looking at, hearing, whatever, as being half the picture of the who we are, what's going on. And we then, if we spend too much time looking at, focusing on things that are about something, thinking about things, then we're missing half of who we are. And the other half of who we are is the mind that's thinking, the mind that's aware, the mind that's mindful. The act of attention that's required to focus on something. So say that I'm very, very concerned with cooking my meal. And so the mind is about cooking the meal. You're thinking about the meal, you're focusing, you're looking at the food and what's going on. And so the focus is about something. But the nature of how that focus is being operating, how we look, how we're paying attention, how we're organizing the mental landscape so we can kind of focus on making this meal, that's not studied. That's taken for granted. It's kind of invisible. And part of what we do in meditation is to turn around 180 degrees and no longer concern ourselves so much with our concerns, but more about the nature of the mind or awareness or attention that is required, needed to have concerns. And this is a difficult move because our concerns are so important. And the nature of attention, awareness, that awareness is needed in order to pay attention. That awareness has no monetary value, and you can't point to it. It has no shape, it has no weight, it has no texture, it has no smell, it's not anything like we usually think of as being something which is important. So naturally we want to focus on things that are important, and often then the tendency is we focus about things, we're concerned. So, but half the picture is the nature of awareness itself, attention itself, being mindful itself. And to make that switch, to start being interested in awareness, attention, can shift a person's sense of perception as radically as if you go from black and white movies to color movies. Those of you who maybe watched Wizard of Oz, the switch that happens. I think of it sometimes as going like from three dimensions of life to four dimensions of life. The fourth dimension being the kind of a certain kind of depth dimension of awareness, attention to the mind itself. So it's quite a, it can not seem important, but it enriches and deepens our life dramatically to have the attention turn around and look at itself, focus on itself. As we do that, then we can have a chance to notice a variety of things about attention or awareness, how we use it, what's the nature of our how we attend, how we focus, how we're involved in concerns, how we do our aboutness. And some of it's pretty interesting. You can see that there's shifts and changes in how attention is used. We sometimes talk about attention as riveted. I remember some years ago, I was driving just around here, Redwood City, peacefully, taking my kids. I think I was taking them to school or something. And a police car came up behind me. And I thought there was nothing wrong with me. So I just, my attention wasn't riveted yet. And I made an unusual turn down an unusual street. And the police car followed. So I didn't think too much about it. But then, because my route involved another unusual turn to a different little street, when the police car followed me again, then my attention was riveted. And it's kind of everything gets kind of narrowed and focused. What's going on and what's the problem here and what's happening? So it's possible to get riveted with the attention. It's also possible for attention to be, our awareness, to be quite relaxed and spacious. Have a nice nap, you're leaning against a nice tree and a nice day, everything is fine, no issues, and you have a nice view maybe. And the mind feels very expansive. And some people love the experience of expansive awareness as opposed to a contracted, focused attention. So we have the ability to have the focus, to be expansive. We also have the ability to have the mind be, or the attention be stable and steady. You put your attention someplace and it stays there. We also have the capacity to have the mind, the attention, the awareness, mindfulness, jump around, hardly be able to have any control over it all. It just jumps around and, flits from one thing to the other quite quickly. So from these examples, you see that when you turn around 180 degrees to look at attention, how we use our attending, that it's a fluid, flexible, or changing kind of phenomena. Because awareness is not a single thing. It's not a unitary thing. It has no shape. But it's a combination of different mental factors that come together to create a sense of awareness, an approach of awareness, attention. And so you can, it's fluid, it's changeable. If you look at how we attend, how we are mindful, how we focus on things, the nature of focusing itself, then it's also possible to see that there's often a lot of attitudes that are embedded in our attending, in our attention, in our awareness. And so, so for example, the common one for some people is there can be some of these attitudes can be very subtle, but pervasive and very deep. That are kind of sometimes involve lifetime habits, and sometimes somewhat invisible, because we haven't stopped to take around to look. So one relatively common one for some people is fear. And when they look out through their eyes, when they look in our attention, there's a certain degree of apprehension or worry that there's a danger, and you're looking, and where's the danger, what's going on, I have to take care of myself. Another attitude, which is pretty common, is there's an attitude of desire. I want something. And you look, when looking and paying attention to anything is how does it fit into my what I want. Or aversion, just kind of, you know, pushing things away, not wanting things. It can be an attitude that's embedded in there that goes along. There's also can be attitudes of self. You know, what's in it for me? How am I, my identity, how I represent myself to the world, how other people see me, very closely intimately tied to how we pay attention. We pay attention to those things which are either going to build us up or criticize us. It's said one of the sad things about human life is that we're energized by people who criticize us and people who praise us, but people who do neither we're bored by. So I don't know if that's true, but if it is true, it's sad. And so I think one of the reasons some people find it's nice to be at home is sometimes at home there aren't so many people to deal with. And when there aren't a lot of people to deal with, sometimes our social concerns about how we fit in and where we go, where we belong and don't operate as so strongly. And so this sense of belonging, a sense of who we are and how we're seen, is sometimes very deeply embedded in how we pay attention. And so just the very nature of paying attention, there is this focus, this concern, that's there in the background. So this kind of a background attitude that can be there embedded in how we are attending, paying attention, is there. The other thing that you might start noticing, if you do this, you quiet down and do this amazing thing, to no longer be focused on all the important things you have to do and be thinking about, and focus on how the mind is operating, how it's paying attention, you can also be aware of whether it's happy or not, or whether it's stressed or not, whether it's relaxed or not. And sometimes the attention can be tense, or the way we're attending and focusing on things can be quite tense, and sometimes it can be quite relaxed. As we turn inward, or do this 180-degree turn, then what we start noticing is not issues which are necessarily particular to us as an individual human being of their own biographical history. If you're thinking about things, sometimes, you know, then it's very interesting. You're thinking, many times it's tied into what's important for me and everything. But as we turn around this 180 degrees, start seeing something which in Buddhism might be called more universal, that which we all human beings share. We share the nature of attending or using our mind to pay attention. We share in the various attitudes and qualities that come into play as we attend or pay attention. And so we start seeing something which is more we have all in common rather than something that's particular to me. And Buddhism says that suffering is something that most people, the 99 plus percent, suffering is, you know, we all share. And that in some ways, you know, it's unfortunate, in some ways it's also quite profound that we share this with each other. It kind of, our common humanity is something that is not a personal failing that we should suffer, but rather something about our shared life that we're trying to find our way together and trying to understand something and hopefully opens our heart to each other. So as we turn around in this 180 degree and look at this other half of our life, the nature of attending, attention, awareness, that's when the Four Noble Truths come into play. Because the Four Noble Truths have a lot to do with how we attend, how we pay attention, the relationship we form with what's going on, the relationship we have as we attend and pay attention to anything at all. What's that relationship that's embedded? That's so sometimes that relationship is, that's embedded, the attitude is quite tenacious. So there are some attitudes that create more stress, more suffering than others, perhaps. And so the Four Noble Truths are pointing to the core or the root activity in the mind that contributes to what in Buddhism is called suffering or stress. And so if we start there, then Buddhism points to what's something that's called tanha. And tanha is a colloquial, in the time of the Buddha, a colloquial word that meant thirst. And so it wasn't a, you know, some big psychologically technical word, just thirst. But not thirst for, you know, for a drink, but more like the thirst, like in English we use the word the thirst for power or the thirst for money or something. There's kind of a drivenness or compulsivity or kind of a craving that the mind is capable of. And when the, I like to think of it as drivenness or compulsion, when the mind contracts around a desire, when the mind gets obsessed about a desire, when the mind has a desire that you can't put down, you can't let go of easily, when the mind is kind of riveted by a desire, caught in the throes of a desire, then it's called tanha, or craving or thirst. And when the mind is riveted or caught in the throes of desire, so it's contracted and tight, then, and sometimes delighted in that desire, delighted in that kind of, you know, sometimes desire, you know, kind of being caught by desire can have a certain kind of energetic delight in it. But still, that itself is stressful. That itself involves a certain degree of suffering. And when it's very strong, it can have a lot of suffering. And when it's built, has a lot of expectation and hope and fear, a lot of sense of self involved and self-representation, when our security and safety and, you know, so many things get tied in to this. The force of being, of drivenness, of being compulsion becomes stronger and stronger. And there gets, and it's a setup for suffering. And so this movement from the mind being in the throes of desire, caught in desire, as the root for our suffering, is the first two of the Four Noble Truths. So the first noble truth begins with the truth that there is suffering. The common human experience, that the 99.99 or so, that there is, you know, the experience of suffering. And the kind of suffering that Buddhism is interested in, looking at and addressing, is that suffering that is defined or by the second noble truth. That suffering that comes out of tanha, or this being caught by desire. And this has an impact on the nature of attention, because of how our mind is operating. Mind is not free when we're caught in these things. The fourth noble truth says that it's possible to cease, bring to an end, the suffering that's caused by being caught by desire. It's possible to get uncaught by desire. It's possible to become free. And it's quite possible, you know, to have desire without being caught by it. It's possible, there's good desires to have and go along. There's some really beautiful, wonderful desires that people can have that, because they're so wonderful and so noble, people sometimes overlook that the how they hold the desire is causing a lot of suffering. And there's desires that are terrible desires to have, but they're held so lightly and loosely that people are free from it. They're not going to act on it because, you know, it's not the nature of desire per se which Buddhism focuses on, the kind of desire, but rather how we hold it, how it effect it has in our mind. So again, this is another way which we keep turning 180 degrees around to look at something that functioning, how this functions within us, rather than focusing on what we're wanting, which is the object, which is aboutness, we can get blind. If we only focus on what we want or what we don't want, the world of aboutness, we're blinded from the other half of what our human nature is about. So it's a very hard training. And a big part of Buddhist training is this training to be willing to turn the attention away from all the things that we're about, all the things that are so important for us, we have to do and fix and manage and get. So we can pay attention to this whole other side, the nature of awareness or attention or attending, how the mind functions. And so the Four Noble Truths are part of this exploration, part of the study of how, you know, this universal, this common characteristics of our mind or our attention, how it functions, how it works. And so we need some help in order to do that well. We need some help in order to study this, to turn this around well. And so the help in order to do this is the Fourth Noble Truth, which is the Eightfold Path. And it helps, for example, you know, if you spend your day robbing and stealing and raping and killing, things like that, you know, then your world is about aboutness, about doing those things. And probably if, you know, you don't go home and just kind of like, you know, relax, you know, and rest in the nature of awareness. You know, probably your mind continues to be obsessed or tight or contracted. And it's, you know, so concerned about those police, you know. I mean, let alone me, you know, the police followed me a few streets and I was riveted, just driving my car. And, but, you know, so certain kinds of living, certain kinds of ways is not conducive for the mind to be stable or steady or calm enough to do this turning around to look. And so part of the Eightfold Path, it's really important for, if you want to get help in doing this kind of big and beautiful thing, it really helps if you live an ethical life. Because an unethical life keeps you agitated, keeps you focused or caught up in the world of aboutness. If you want to free yourself from aboutness, it helps if your ethical life is clean or clear or good. So focusing on your speech and how you speak is an important part of that ethics. Focusing on behavior so you don't kill and steal and involve sexual misconduct. And then also about your livelihood. Focusing on how you make a livelihood for yourself that is supportive of this process of turning around to look at the heart, you know, how the mind functions. It's a 180-degree turn. So those are the middle section of the Eightfold Path. It also helps if you have a good understanding about the Four Noble Truths, you know, what's going on here. So the first step of the Eightfold Path is right view. And one of the common ways of defining right view is that you're looking at your experience through the perspective of the first three Noble Truths. So, you know, if what you want to do is to free the mind, free that other half of ourselves from the attitudes of being contracted or tight or caught or drivenness, and set it free, which is a beautiful thing, to have the heart or the mind set free and relaxed and not caught, to be at ease and to be at peace with itself, is one of the beautiful things to have happen. But if you want that, it's hard to do that if you think that your spiritual life will find its culmination, satisfaction, meaning by if you can just find the right crystal. And you go around to crystal shops, and crystals are nice, and maybe they're even powerful, but you know, if you find the right crystal, then you can, everything will be okay. If you do that, you're looking in the wrong direction. Because the direction you need to look at is not at the crystal, which is, again, is a world of aboutness, you're focusing outside yourself, but you have to be willing to turn around and look at where the problem is. You know, where your attachment is, where your clinging is. Don't expect the crystal to help when you're the one who's clinging. So there's many ways in which people focus on things which aren't really direct and to the point. And the Four Noble Truths, I find it quite beautiful because they're to the point. They're very simple. They're just to the point. You look directly at where the problem is. And so the first of the Four Noble Truths involves, I think I understand it to be, a willingness to do this turn, 180-degree turn, to begin looking here at what your contribution is to the suffering. And this also is very hard. Many people suffer for terrible reasons which they don't feel they're responsible for. And so then it's easy, if we stay the victim, to blame them, blame it, blame my illness, blame whatever, and focus again outward to a world of aboutness. In order to turn 180 degrees around to get the other half of our life, we have to be interested in taking, you know, what is our contribution? What are we adding? That's where the Eightfold Path, that's where the Four Noble Truths are about, our contribution. So there has to be a willingness to suspend at the appropriate time blaming other people's responsibility for what's going on in order to find out, what am I doing? And if you never do that, then you miss half your life. So to turn around and look, what's my contribution? And then there's the practices of beginning to use your mind differently. It's not just a matter of looking, but which is mindfulness, the seventh step of the Eightfold Path. Start looking more carefully at what's here. And then concentration, the eighth step of the Eightfold Path, steadying your mind so the mindfulness can be more pure, more focused, can look more deeply. And as you see how the mind functions, how it operates, what you're doing, then we can start making choices. And we can make choices to let go of those things which cause the mind or the heart to suffer. And we can do those things in the mind which helps it be more, you know, at peace or at ease or happy. And we can watch what the choices we have in the mind, in our hearts, and what we do in there. The mental landscape. And this is a hugely important thing in Buddhism, Buddhist practice, is to begin taking not only responsibility for a mind, but begin discovering where we have some agency to make a difference. So it could be as simple as, to use a simple example, you know, I could be driving someplace and notice that I'm a little bit tense. If I turn around 180 degrees around, stop focusing on where I'm trying to get to and what I'm thinking about, and turn around and look at my tension, I see the tension has to do with how I'm driving. I look more carefully, I see the tension is there because I'm focused so much on the fear that if I come late, the person's going to be angry with me if I come late for my appointment. So maybe that's a reasonable movement of the mind. But if I turn around, I say, now, can I take responsibility for that? Can I change that inner landscape? Can I let go of my fear? Or can I let go of my impatience? Or can I at least let go of the ways in which I'm driving in such a forceful, fast way? And as I do that, as I change that, then things calm down for me a little bit. If I don't do that, things probably will speed up. So the Eightfold Path, part of it involves beginning to take responsibility for the inner landscape and learning how to navigate it and to make choices that are different than how we're just kind of barreling along on our own. As the Eightfold Path becomes stronger for us, as it becomes a bigger part of our life, the function of that is to help us with this work of turning inward and seeing deeper and deeper. But not just seeing deeper and deeper, but I like to think of it as simplifying the inner landscape of attention, of awareness, of how we attend. So that our attending, the way we are paying attention, the way we are aware, becomes a simpler and simpler act. So it's just paying attention. We're just present and paying attention without a lot of desires embedded in our attention, without a lot of fear or aversion, without a lot of concern for self, or self-representation, or what people think, we have an increased capacity for simple attention, simple presence. And the process of simplifying attention or awareness, all the extraneous kind of extras that get somehow entangled with it, is a really beautiful thing. And to discover through a simpler and simpler capacity to be, a simpler capacity just to be aware and to be here, is one of the great gifts. Things don't have to be, we don't have to be, when we stop being so entangled in how things are. The Four Noble Truths, as I understand them, are support and help for us to be at peace in the simplicity of our attention or awareness. To realize this other half of who we are, the subjective landscape of attention or awareness, has a capacity of luminous clarity, openness, relaxation, peace, that for me is very closely associated with being very simple. So little is necessary. And so the part of the process of using the Four Noble Truths is the process of beginning to let go of all the extra stuff that we kind of pile on top of our capacity of to simply be present, simply to be. And as we simply be, as half of us, the subjective side of attention, attending becomes simpler and clearer and less entangled and less driven, then we can still be involved in the world of aboutness. We still take care of things, be involved, but we tend to get involved in the world with our concerns in a much more relaxed and easy way. And we don't invest so much important, desperate importance in that half of our life. And you can be more balanced. So my proposal to you, I don't know if it's true or not, is that my proposal is that there's a good chance that most of you have lived an imbalanced life. And you're focused on that half that has to do with aboutness. And I would love that this talk nudges you to correct that balance. And so you become equally balanced on the two sides. Sides of aboutness and the sides of beingness. And may your beingness be simple and peaceful and a gift to the world. So thank you.